At Fort Hood, is diversity in the military suddenly the victim of collateral damage?
Our diversity, not only in our Army, but in our country, is a strength. And as horrific as this tragedy was, if our diversity becomes a casualty, I think that's worse.
The Army Chief of Staff weighs in on the Fort Hood shootings with a defense of the military's famed success with diversity, racial, gender, and religious. But did diversity take a shot from the gun of alleged shooter Nidal Walik Hassan? Diversity in the Stockade on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, November 9th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, John. Coming up on the program today, we'll be talking more about Fort Hood and specifically stresses on families. How do families deal with extreme stress in the military or out? Also, look ahead to the big news, the agenda today, letting us know what we need to keep track of this week. And President Obama is on the way to his first trip to China since he got to the White House.
But first, we're going to talk about the challenges of diversity, as we mentioned, in the military in the wake of the Fort Hood tragedy in just a moment. But Olga Pena is here, editor of the Killeen Daily Herald, the civilian newspaper which serves the Fort Hood community. She helped us to stay on top of the details last Friday morning and joins us again today. Olga, good morning. What's the update down there in Killeen?
Good morning. I think today we're all waiting to hear what happens with the suspect who is finally off a ventilator, but we do not know yet if he has spoken with investigators. Everyone's looking for answers as to why, what triggered this terrible tragedy.
And he is expected to survive. That, of course, is the news that we're certain about over the weekend. But what details are we learning about his sort of demeanor and his background over the last few years?
Well, we're learning about his various transfers and that they were close together, so perhaps there were problems, although the last we heard from right here in Fort Hood is that he did not have any problems that we know of in the hospital as far as behavioral. So we're trying to piece together the pieces as why that day he was handing out his furniture, he was handing out the Quran, what really took place in his mind.
And was there some trigger point? That's going to be the focus of investigators. Olga Pena, editor of the Killeen Daily Herald, thanks so much for the update. We're going to talk more about Fort Hood this morning, but first, all the other headlines in the news.
The focus on health care is shifting to the Senate after the House voted in favor of its bill on Saturday. Don't hold your breath, though. Health care overhaul faces a unified Republican opposition in the Senate. Hurricane warnings are posted along the Gulf Coast from Mississippi to Florida. That says Hurricane Ida is downgraded to a Category 1 storm. It's due to make landfall tomorrow. A Fort Hood spokesman says the Texas base is moving forward with soldiering after last week's mayhem. The community took time yesterday to mourn the 13 killed and 29 injured in the gunman's rampage. The mourning included a church service that was held in the base, led by Army Chaplain Colonel Frank Jackson.
So, Lord, as we pray together, we focus on things we know. We are humbled and grateful for the outpouring of love and the support of this community and our nation.
The suspected shooter, Major Nidal Walik Hassan, remains in stable but critical condition.
World leaders, past and present, have gathered in the German capital, Berlin, celebrating 20 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. As part of the festivities, 1,000 giant painted dominoes are being toppled as a symbolic reenactment of the end of the Cold War. President Obama will meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today, and the Supreme Court will consider arguments for juveniles discussing whether sentencing a juvenile to life in prison with no chance of parole is cruel and unusual punishment. Wall Street opens mostly flat today, and it was flat on Friday. The Dow kicks off at 10,023. What do you think of our coverage of the Fort Hood shooting?
This is Carrie, an Army lieutenant from Washington, D.C. Absolutely, yes, his religion plays a part in what he did. First, you have to decide if it was a jihad. Of course it plays a part. And second, he may have suffered from religiosity, not just depression, which would have played an important part in choosing why he did what he did.
Is religion relevant to the discussion of the aftermath of the Fort Hood shootings? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to continue to look at the reaction in the community, and it is a community.
Absolutely.
Around Fort Hood, Texas, dealing with the aftermath of the shootings last week. 13 people killed, 29 wounded. Here is a soldier. Mandy Foster's the wife of a soldier wounded in that Fort Hood shooting.
I didn't think it was real until I got to the hospital. I didn't know what to think when everything happened.
Her husband is Private Joseph Foster, who was shot in the hip. And he says despite his injury, he's planning to ship out to Afghanistan, and he says he's ready to ship out in January. So there are more details emerging about the suspect, Nidal Malik Hassan. Hassan is an American Muslim, something we're trying to reconcile as whether it's a legitimate issue to talk about this morning. Many of you have weighed in on that and said, no, it's not a legitimate issue. Others have said, please, we need to know more. But we want to hear all of your responses at 8778-MY-TAKE. That's a place for you to go to tell your story or thetakeaway.org. But the issue we raised right at the top of the hour, it was raised yesterday on Meet the Press by Army Chief of Staff General George Casey, and it's worth playing that clip again. Let's hear.
Our diversity, not only in our Army, but in our country, is a strength. And as horrific as this tragedy was, if our diversity becomes a casualty, I think that's worse.
Well, there's the question. Did diversity take a hit in the shootings last Thursday? To discuss this is Jamal Badani. He's first sergeant in the Marine Corps Reserves, founder of the Association of Patriotic Arab Americans in the Military. He's Muslim himself. Also with us is John Allen Williams, professor of political science at Loyola University in Chicago. He's chair and president of the Inter-University Seminar of Armed Forces and Society. He's a retired, U.S. Navy Reserve captain. So let's begin with Jamal Badani. Sergeant, are there special issues related to diversity in the military regarding religion, especially with being a Muslim American in the services?
Let me tell you about the Association of Patriotic Arab Americans in the Military.
Sure.
You know, Arab Americans, a lot of people think, well, if you're Arab, you're Muslim, and that's not the case.
Right.
Arab Americans are Christian. You have Jewish Arabs. You've got some who don't believe in religion. And, of course, you have Muslims as well, because Islam began in Saudi Arabia. So I just want to make that clear, that our organization, we have members who are Christian. We have members who are Muslim. We're a non-political, secular organization, so I don't want people to make the mistake to think that our veterans organization is a religious organization. I want to be very clear about that.
Right. I mean, and of course, your urging clarity here is I think, also implicitly, it comes with the idea that there's sensitivity here. I mean, you're worried that the words can be taken incorrectly and the wrong way in this kind of a situation. How are you feeling, a few days after this alleged shooting rampage by Mr. Nidal Malik Hassan, a major and a psychiatrist in the U.S. Army down at Fort Hood?
Yeah, a friend of mine called me. I was working on Thursday when this happened, and a friend of mine called me and told me about the news. I mean, I'm not even watching the news, and I literally was in rush hour. I live and work in the D.C. area, and the rush hour is really bad here.
Sure.
And I was getting calls from media, I was getting calls from reporters, getting calls from community leaders, and I hadn't even seen anything on this. But as I started thinking about it, I'm thinking, man, this is really bad for our community and for our, perception-wise, for Arab Americans who are serving, Muslims who are serving, definitely bad for the community, because since 9/11, what we learned at 9/11 is when a terrorist attacked our country, is we were grieving for our country being attacked, and then not more than 15 minutes later, when reports came out that these individuals were that flew into the towers and attacked our country were of Muslim and Arab background. Then we started receiving backlash and discrimination because of that.
Right.
And well, my family experienced it. My oldest daughter experienced it in school, who, by the way, has blonde hair, blue eyes. It was the first time that she was made to feel different.
Well, Jamal, let's get a comment from Professor Williams. How has the military dealt with this in the years since 9/11? And in general, does the military offer religious services on an ecumenical basis, sort of interfaith, or do they try to serve each individual faith separately?
Well, the military's always had the problem of trying to please the Catholics and the Protestants, and you have different chaplains. There are Jewish chaplains, and there are now Muslim chaplains as well, and they're responsive to the increasing numbers of proud and patriotic Muslims who are serving in our military now. General Casey has it exactly right. You don't want a backlash on this. to cause discrimination against the somewhat 3,000 Muslims who are serving right now in the Army, and including First Sergeant's service now in the Marine Corps Reserve.
Although, Jay, that's a tiny number in a huge military, and I wonder if there's a feeling of being a tiny, tiny minority, and what are the specific religious challenges for empowering and protecting members of the Muslim community inside the military?
Well, I think probably First Sergeant can speak better to that than I can. The numbers are what they are, and I would hope that there will be more. But the question that you posed at the top of the hour, whether we should ignore or mention faith in this connection, strikes me as really the wrong question. The question is, faith is going to be discussed. It is going to be thought of by lots of people who hear about this. And the question is, what was the role of this man's particular faith, assuming he did it, in what he did? It doesn't mean that the faith caused it. It certainly doesn't mean that there was a conspiracy. But something happened that turned an Army psychiatrist, apparently, into a killer.
All right. And certainly that's the focus of the investigation. John Allen Williams, professor of political science at Loyola University Chicago, chair and president of the Inner University Seminar of Armed Forces and Society. He's also a retired U.S. Naval Reserve captain. Thank you, sir.
Yes.
And Sergeant Jamal Badani, do you have anything final to say about that? I mean, you are a tiny minority in the military. Quickly.
Talk about numbers here, because
very quickly.
You said they're small. You got to understand, our service and sacrifice to this country began during the Revolutionary War. The first Arab American to die for this country was Private Nathan Bedeen on May 26, 1776. He was with the 18th Continental Army out of Massachusetts. Died before our independence. 5,000 Muslim Americans served on both sides of the Civil War.
Those are good numbers. A long and proud history for Americans of Muslim background in the U.S. military. Jamal Badani, first sergeant in the Marine Corps Reserves and founder of the Association of Patriotic Arab Americans in the Military, and we thank him. It's 15 minutes after the hour, so let's check in on some of the top stories that we're following.
After a sweeping overhaul of the nation's health care system passed the House by 5 votes over the weekend, the intensely partisan battle begins.
Now it falls on the United States Senate to take the baton and bring this effort to the finish line on behalf of the American people. And I'm absolutely confident that they will.
He's confident, President Obama, about the largest expansion of health care coverage in 45 years, getting it signed by the end of the year. But Senator Lindsey Graham told CBS that Republicans are gearing up for a fight.
The House bill is dead on arrival in the Senate. Just look at how it passed. It passed 220 to 215. It passed by 2 votes. You had 39 Democrats vote against the bill.
A major sticking point continues to be the creation of the public option, the government health care program, to compete with private insurers.
Continuing now with the Fort Hood story. The gunman in that shooting rampage at Fort Hood, Texas, remains in critical but stable condition this morning. An Army spokesman says Major Nidal Hassan's condition has not changed since he was taken off a ventilator, and that happened on Saturday. The Supreme Court is considering arguments whether sentencing a juvenile to life in prison with no chance of parole is cruel and unusual punishment, particularly if there's no homicide involved. The cases being heard today involve life sentences given to 13-year-olds for rape and to a 16-year-old for armed robbery. The Constitution of the U.S. explicitly forbids cruel and unusual punishment. The leader of one of the largest drug cartels in Mexico has been killed during a gun battle with police. The Drug Enforcement Administration says the cartel Los Zetas is among the most advanced and violent of Mexico's drug gangs.
And finally, a New Hampshire man has hit a $1 million lottery jackpot for the second time in four years. Bob Jarax had my ticket. He says his wife didn't believe him when he told her he'd won. That's a
bury
look at
the lead.
Some of the stories we're watching.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now some quick takeouts on stories you're following all this week. We'll go to Todd Zwillick first, our Washington correspondent. And as we've been saying, the House has passed major health reform legislation by a narrow margin, but they did pass it. And Democrats are pretty happy about it. Here's a reaction from Sunday morning from House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer.
For all of my friends in the press who have been assaulting me in the hallways, asking if we had the votes, the answer is yes.
So, Todd, he sounds happy, obviously, but again, this is a very small margin they won by. Was it closer than you thought?
Close. A margin of just, 220 to 215 is really a margin of just 3 votes. It's a swing of just 3 votes. I don't know if it was closer than I thought it would be. We were all watching the board really closely, and it barely got passed. But you got to look inside the numbers here a little bit, Celeste. 39 Democrats voted against this bill. And it's not just any bill. This is the president's top domestic priority and the Democrats' top domestic priority. And when you look into those numbers, you know that the Democratic landslide from last year where all these Democrats swept into office. Well, that was Barack Obama's coattails, and nearly half of the freshmen who came into office on that big wave last year, half of them voted against this. So they have already decided that voting for Obamacare or Pelosi care or supporting the Democrats on their top domestic priority is a way that they can't get reelected. And that tells you a lot about what the Democrats are going to be able to do for the rest of this term up until 2010, which is probably not much.
Okay, but very, very quickly, what does this narrow margin mean about the battle in the Senate once we have to reconcile these bills?
Right, and many people see this House vote really as the high watermark for what Democrats were going to be able to do. At least the Democratic base would be able to get out of health reform. You know, as hard as this was to do in the House, I'm sorry to say, it was the easy part. They squeaked by 220 to 215 in the Senate. A majority that thin just doesn't cut it. We all know that. Now, Senator Joe Lieberman, who caucuses with the Democrats, he's already said and repeated this weekend that he will not support a Democratic bill that includes the public option.
Okay.
So now Harry Reid has to get on with his 60 Democrats, and he doesn't even have 60 at the starting line.
Okay, Todd Zwill is our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
I'm sorry, so sorry.
I made a boo-boo.
So our business takeout comes in the form of a high-profile apology this morning. Louise Story from our partner in the New York Times, finance reporter. Good morning.
Good morning. Who's
crying now, Louise?
Well, this is John Reed. He's one of the ones with Sandy Weill who really built Citigroup into what it is. And this is notable because we've seen very few big Wall Street bankers apologize.
And what's he doing? He's sort of doing a little dog and pony show down in Washington this morning.
Well, he said, I'm sorry. And he said that back in 1990, he pushed for the Glass-Steagall repeal.
Deregulation.
Right. This is a law from the 1930s that separated banking activities, the trading from the deposit. He pushed for the repeal. And he's saying now, I was wrong. I'm sorry. We should bring it back.
Is he the only big finance guy? And again, he's not taking credit for the entire financial meltdown.
Right.
Maybe he should. That would be nicer if he did. But is he the only big finance guy looking,
No.
lobbying for regulatory reform?
So Paul Volcker, who used to be in charge of the Federal Reserve, he's very high profile. He advised the Obama campaign on economics. He also has said, we need to bring back some form of Glass-Steagall. We need to separate the risky trading that got us in trouble from the deposit taking. The only thing is, the Obama administration doesn't seem to be listening to Paul Volcker anymore.
So these finance voices, John Reed, Paul Volcker, are not going to increase the likelihood that regulatory reform gets passed.
It doesn't seem like it right now. Mm-hmm. Even with all the I'm sorry's, it doesn't seem like it.
All right. Thanks for that takeout from Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners, the
Thank
New York
you.
Times.
Now let's go to sports with our Takeaway Sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
So, Guns N' Roses for you, dude.
Yeah, I was about to say, that sounds like a little Guns N' Roses.
It is Guns N' Roses this morning, which, we don't want to, we can combine the roses with the football, but hopefully not the guns. So let's talk about the Indianapolis Colts because they did hold on to their undefeated record, but barely, 20-17 against the Texans. This is what came in with 1 second left.
42-yard kick this time for Chris Brown to tie. Snap. The ball is down. The kick's on its way. And it is no good. He missed it. He missed it. Colts win. Colts win. Colts win. He missed the 42-yarder.
I think the Colts won.
Colts lucky.
Understand that a little bit. The backdrop is that the kicker Chris Brown had already kicked the 50-yarder that same day.
Right.
So him being on the line to kick that one, it seemed like a lock, and the Colts were going to lose their first game. But what also comes out of that, Peyton Manning is the first quarterback ever to throw for 40,000 yards in a single decade. And he threw 19 passes in the first quarter. He's a prolific passer. The Colts are starting to feel like a team of destiny, like they're marching towards the Super Bowl.
Team of destiny.
Well, but Manning is absolutely stellar. He's a once-in-a-lifetime kind of player.
Without a doubt. And so people are comparing him and Drew Brees as the two best players in the league. And Drew Brees
quarterback for the Saints.
And the New Orleans Saints, they stayed undefeated as well by
right.
beating the Carolina Panthers.
Well, although the Panthers and the Texans, come on. These aren't really strong teams.
Well, the teams that are playing good football against other teams, against top, you know, contenders. The other game I wanted to talk about is last night's game. The Cowboys beat the Eagles 20-16 in the NFC East showdown that basically showed that the NFC East top two teams, the Cowboys and the Eagles, are running away from the hapless New York Giants.
Oh, hapless. That is a compliment compared to what the Giants are.
Poor
hapless.
Giants.
No.
Started the season with such high hopes.
They were 5-0 to begin the season. They've lost four games in a row. They're one of the first, they're the second team that's been 5-0 to lose four games straight after
no
that.
No defense. They should play jacks, not football.
And the Miami Dolphins, who you like, lost to the New England Patriots. Now, so
they lost 27-17, and the Dolphins, they're playing great football. They're doing their best, but the Patriots are definitely another team that knows how to win tough games.
See if the Colts can handle the Patriots next week. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is a Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good morning.
Coming up, we're going to check the agenda. What's on tap for the week ahead? Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we'll check out this week's agenda, the stories we want you to keep on top of for the week ahead. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. We're just getting news that Kraft Foods has formally made a $16.3 billion bid for a hostile takeover of the British chocolate maker Cadbury.
Cadbury
has resisted the takeover. After a landmark win in the House, President Obama has handed out chocolate bars. No, he's beginning his push for health care reform in the Senate.
Given the heated and often misleading rhetoric surrounding this legislation, I know that this was a courageous vote for many members of Congress.
And speaking of heated rhetoric, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says it's not just Republicans who are in opposition to the bill.
You had 39 Democrats vote against the bill. They come from red states, moderate Democrats from swing districts. They bailed out on this bill. It was a bill written by liberals for liberals.
Senator Lindsey Graham told CBS that the bill passed the House over the weekend but is dead on arrival in the Senate.
Today's the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Thousands are celebrating at the Brandenburg Gate today, where giant dominoes are being toppled to show how communist governments in Eastern Europe fell one after another back in 1989. President Obama will delay his visit to Asia to attend a formal memorial ceremony at Fort Hood, which is scheduled for tomorrow. Colonel Frank Jackson is a U.S. Army chaplain who led a memorial service yesterday on the base.
The scripture that comes to my mind is that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And as a congregation, we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. We can recover, we can be resilient, and we can also reach out to those who are hurting.
Jackson says he sought to share words of hope and comfort at the memorial service yesterday. This week at the box office, the Jim Carrey remake of the classic story A Christmas Carol pulled in $31 million. It beat out Michael Jackson's concert film This Is It and George Clooney's new movie The Men Who Stare at Goats. Of course, a movie titled The Men Who Stare at Goats could not possibly be number one in the box office. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Our government. Iran. Your government.
Proliferation. Public
option. A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
Okay, it's Monday. That means it's time to check on the agenda of what's coming up this week in the news. Joining us is Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times, and also Chris Hogg, a correspondent in Shanghai for our partner, the BBC. Good morning to both of you. We need to start this morning with in Fort Hood. That's the tragedy, obviously, that's been dominating the news since it happened last Thursday. Here's what Army Chief of Staff General George Casey had to say on Meet the Press yesterday.
Now, I will tell you that we will take a hard look at ourselves as an Army, because we want to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again. And it's our ethos here to look hard at things, ask ourselves the hard questions, and then adapt and adjust based on that.
So, Marcus, what are the hard questions? What are these changes that they're probably going to have to move forward with in the Army to make sure this doesn't happen again?
Well, the hardest questions are questions of how do you take care of your soldiers and sailors and airmen, too, for that matter, psychologically. How do you ensure their mental health in times of stress, in times of war, in times of two wars, multiple wars? And then that's the first question. That applies to all our servicemen and women. The second question is, how do you take care of the mental health of the caregivers? How do you take care of those who are taking care of everyone else? And then finally, there's a third question, which has to do with discrimination and openness. The military has actually been the most successfully integrated institution in American life, and it wasn't easy at the beginning, but they have done better than the rest of us, and then corporate America, than other parts of our society. So the question for them now becomes, how do you deal with, however, the fact that when you have such a diverse force, and you do, incredibly diverse, we saw in the victims from Fort Hood, then how do you make sure the discrimination is kept to a minimum? How do you teach people, many of them who are young, how to deal with that, and how, you know, there's some natural differences here, and how do you not exacerbate those? And those will become harder now, obviously, in the wake of this tragedy.
Diversity of the victims.
That's a really good point. You know, one of the things that many people have been pointing to is that the shooter, Major Hassan, was going to be deployed to Iraq, and people are questioning whether or not this shooting occurred prior to his deployment. And so people are talking a lot about extended deployments, long stays, and soldiers getting very few breaks. Is that one of the things the Army's looking at?
They are looking at it, but they've been looking at it for a while, and it's really hard, just the stress on this, on the force, which everyone has talked about, and now we have a reality of it coming, bursting tragically into view. This is where kind of the reality of America's national interests and defending those kind of collide with the very human interest of keeping these men and women alive, and how do you deal with living this? Unfortunately, you can't let your national security or your foreign policy be dictated by those kinds of realities. It's really, really sad and really cold-hearted to say it, but the president can't decide, for instance, on the Afghanistan policy based on this tragedy. He can't.
And moving on to President Obama, he's going to make his first visit to Asia since he got into the White House, which is kind of silly because, you know, it's his first year in office. Most of his trips are going to be his first visits. But let's go to Chris Hogg. You were based first in Japan, and now you're based in Shanghai, China. He's going to be visiting Japan, China, Singapore, and South Korea. So what do we know about this president's visit? What is his purpose in visiting these four countries?
Well, in terms of what the White House is saying, they're saying that it's going to be about security, it's about non-proliferation, he's going to be talking about energy and climate change. In Japan, of course, he'll be meeting the new government there. There's a tricky issue there because the Japanese government wants to renegotiate the relocation of a U.S. Army base down on Okinawa. The Americans are very unhappy about that. He then travels down to Singapore for the APEC summit. APEC, you'll know, is the grouping of nations from around the Pacific Ocean. So he'll have a range of meeting with different leaders there. And then, of course, he comes to China, where he'll be talking, we expect, about climate change. But also, he can't ignore these concerns that there's a trade war breaking out between these two countries.
Okay, and is he going to get a different reception with the Obama administration and, say, the Bush administration enjoyed in Asia?
I think at this stage, the biggest concern that countries have is that they still don't quite know how to treat President Obama. I mean, I mentioned trade there. There's been a lot of concern in China that he's been making decisions about tariffs that have been quite different to the kind of decisions that we were getting from the Bush administration. That he seems to, the perception is that he's pandering to the unions, that kind of thing, and that worries people. The other concern that all these countries have about President Obama and this administration is, do they care enough about what's going on in Asia? The former American ambassador to Japan once told me that the most dangerous thing in this part of the world, which could be a very dangerous part of the world, is if America takes its eye off the ball and gets bogged down in its problems elsewhere.
Right. Chris Hogg is the correspondent in China for our partner, the BBC. Thanks, Chris. Marcus, let's move on to healthcare briefly. The House passed their version of healthcare reform on Saturday. Obama is saying now it passes on to the Senate, and he's saying the Senate is going to get this passed. Is that realistic? Are we going to see the Senate pass their version?
Well, the great thing about this issue, in addition to the fact it's a huge issue, affects 18% of our national economy, is the question we really get to see, and I think you really get to see it this week, what is the leadership of Obama really about? Is he going to be busting heads like a Lyndon Baines Johnson would be to make this historic change happen? You kind of find it hard to imagine he wouldn't, because the stakes could not be higher. If the Democrats were to deliver half a loaf, meaning, you know,
just the House,
a huge majority in the House, only to deliver the House with all those Democrats who defected, and that, you know, one Republican who came to their side, Congressman Goh from Louisiana, and then to fail in the Senate, it would be unimaginable, and it would actually have huge consequences for their party next year in the election.
And the Republicans have promised to derail it. We'll see if that happens. Marcus Mabry is the international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks, Marcus. Coming up, we talk about family life every Monday. Later this hour, we're going to talk about stress and how families deal with stress when parents serve in the military and are deployed, and even normal families that don't get deployed overseas, how kids and families deal with stress coming up.
They're not abnormal.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to imply that in any way.
Military families are not
shape
abnormal.
Or form.
Yeah, so we just want a little email traffic this morning.
Certainly not more than other families.
Yeah.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. The Cold War was, of course, famously about socialism and capitalism. It was also about the respective prowesses of the militaries of the Soviet Union and the United States. But 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it fell, famously, 21 years ago, no one wants the Soviets back, but how is capitalism doing? And the best person to talk about that, of course, is Neil Ferguson, history professor at Harvard University, who joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's also the author of The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning. How are you?
And great, but capitalism isn't doing so well this morning. A new BBC Global poll says that only the U.S. and Pakistan are satisfied with free market capitalism 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Put that in some context for us, will you?
Well, first of all, I seem to recollect from a casual look at this poll that they didn't poll anyone in China, which is the biggest economy in terms of population and
indeed,
certainly the most capitalistic at the moment. So I'm not sure you haven't got a problem of sample bias here. But obviously, in the wake of a financial crisis as big as the one we've seen since 2007, people are feeling pretty hurt and disillusioned. But I don't think that constitutes a sort of implicit vote to go back to before 1989, rebuild the Berlin Wall, and restore real existing socialism in large tracts of Eastern Europe. I think our memories may perhaps be short, but most people have a fairly clear idea that the Soviet system and its various spin-offs works even worse than capitalism.
Well, you make an excellent point that China wasn't sampled in this poll, or at least not as far as we know. And in fact, part of the history of the fall of the Berlin Wall was the fall of the global relevance, or the decline of the global relevance of this European divide between the superpowers. It's vanished without a trace. And really, if there were to be a wall today, it would be located somewhere, you know, east of the Caucasus.
Well, there are still remaining walls in the sense that Korea is still divided the way that that Germany once was, and as in the German case, there's a totally dysfunctional communist Korea, and there's a highly successful capitalist Korea. I mean, these experiments just are gradually dwindling, I suppose, into insignificance. Ultimately, there will be no North Korea, I would guess, 10, certainly 20 years from now, and I suspect there won't be a communist regime in Cuba either. So these are the death throes of a system that failed. You know, when we discuss the failings of capitalism, and there unquestionably are profound failings in capitalism, it increases inequality if it's left to its own devices, and it's certainly crisis prone. But, you know, remember what Churchill said about democracy. Famously, he said it was the worst of all possible systems, apart from all the others we've tried from time to time. And I think exactly the same thing applies to capitalism.
And I think if there's anything of a legacy of, not socialism, I suppose, but if the calls for more regulation is an indication that the capitalism of the future will be a hybrid of regulatory central planning and free market capitalism to avoid the kinds of pitfalls and inequalities that you're talking about. And again, that's an experiment that has an imperfect verdict at this point. But Neil Ferguson, thanks so much for being with us. Neil Ferguson is a history professor at Harvard University and the author of The Ascent of Money, the Financial History of the World, looking 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Professor Ferguson, thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Veterans Day is on Wednesday. We have a question this morning. How do you measure stress in a military family? How do you keep track of the stress of children and family members given the deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq? It's a significant challenge for any family. More on that in just a moment. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Fort Hood, where there's plenty of stress this morning, held mourning ceremonies yesterday for last Thursday's shootings in which 13 people died. The suspected shooter, American Muslim Major Nidal Malik Hassan, remains in critical condition in the hospital. Meanwhile, the head of the Army, General George Casey, says diversity in the armed forces must not become a victim of this incident. Speaking on The Takeaway earlier this morning, political scientist and retired Navy Reserve Captain John Allen Williams says General Casey's comments are important.
You don't want a backlash on this to cause discrimination against the somewhat 3,000 Muslims who are serving right now in the Army.
As political scientist, retired Navy Captain John Allen Williams speaking on The Takeaway earlier, Barack Obama has delayed a trip to Asia to attend a formal memorial service in Fort Hood on Tuesday. Bit of business news. In the past hour, Kraft Foods has formally made a $16.3 billion hostile takeover bid for British chocolate maker Cadbury. They call it confections over there in the UK. Cadbury has so far resisted the takeover.
After a landmark win in the House, President Obama begins his push for health care reform in the Senate. Republicans have been pointing out that it's not just members of their party against this bill. 39 Democrats in the House voted against it. And looking ahead to later today, the Supreme Court's considering whether sentencing a juvenile to life in prison with no chance of parole is cruel and unusual punishment, particularly if there's no homicide involved. The cases being heard today involve life sentences given to a 13-year-old for rape and to a 16-year-old for armed robbery. That's a look at some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually there we are, all in what we are is still family.
Continuing our discussion now, the aftermath of the Fort Hood shootings in our family segment today, we want to focus on military families. How do you find the ability to say we are family in a family where parents are continually deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, as is the case in military families? And we talked a lot about on Friday about how the shootings at Fort Hood really took away from the people of that military base the sense of safety. There's a sense of safety that now needs to be restored inside that base, inside the gates of that base. But there's also a sense of safety inside each family that needs to be restored, not just in the aftermath of Fort Hood, but also almost every single day military families face this idea of where is safety in our family. So to talk about that, we have Angela Huebner, Associate Professor of Marriage and Family Therapy Program at Virginia Tech. She spoke with us also last Friday. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning.
Lucien Bouc is a retired Army specialist who was also a part of the deployment and mobilization program at Fort Polk's Family Readiness Center. Lucien, good morning.
Good morning.
And Lisa Belkin, of course, writes the family and parenting blog Motherload for the New York Times. Good morning to you too, Lisa.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
So, Lucien Bouc, let me begin with this question. How do families maintain the center of safety within the borders of the family when there are so many vulnerabilities, including an event like this at Fort Hood?
Well, we just kind of go off the training that we've received. You know, even family members have training that is available to them. And we just base ourselves on our faith, and we just try to hold on.
Now, is that I don't want to characterize too much, but is that a desperate kind of white-knuckled process, or do you have a lot of support around you?
Oh, no. The Army community is great. We have so many resources available to us, and it's all free of charge to all of the Army family. There's no reason why anyone cannot get the assistance that they need.
Angela Huebner, do you believe that the resources are available in quantities appropriate to the scale of the problem for military families?
I think they definitely are. I think the military has done a great job in trying to address that issue. The problem seems to be that the gap between what's available and what's actually used, and sometimes those are very different things.
I see. And how did that manifest itself quickly?
Well, so there are a vast number of really great services around, but not every family member will access those. Not every service member will choose to use those, either because they don't think they need them, they don't recognize they need them, or they think that that's not a good thing to do.
And for military families, the problem for children is special in the sense that they don't have maybe the autonomy to go and seek those services. Lisa Belkin, what are the difficulties in assessing the stress level of kids in military families and in civilian families, for that matter?
Well, it's interesting. The studies that have been done show that kids are just more stressed. All kids are more stressed now. The American Psychological Association actually came out with numbers last week that said a third of them report being more stressed than they were a year ago. And those are all kids. One can only imagine the cohort that's sending parents off to Iraq and Afghanistan. And really interesting is that the parents did not have the same sense in these studies that you ask the kids, what are you worrying about and how worried are you? And in large percentages, they are worried. And you ask the parents, and the parents say far lower percentages think that their kids are stressed out. So there's the first hurdle, is just figuring out what's going on in your kid's head.
Well, Lisa, number one, how do you know when your child is under stress? And when your family is under stress, whether it's in the military because of a deployment or even in the civilian family, if you're unemployed or some of the stresses that people are going through right now, once you notice that your kid is stressed, how do you fix that when your family stress is not going to go down?
Right. I mean, the thing to look for, they always say, is a change. So if your child is exuberant and becomes quiet, if they are, kind of even-keeled and become hot-tempered. But when you're dealing with long-time stress, you're not necessarily going to see a change. It may have happened a long time ago. The answer always seems to come down to talk to your kids. It sounds simplistic and it sounds like a little pat on the head, but if you're constantly talking and, most importantly, giving them permission to talk, and the corollary to that, listening.
All right. Well,
that is what everyone keeps telling us.
Well, let's take that directly to Lucien Bouc. I mean, this is a tangible issue in your family. The research shows that parents have maybe a different assessment of where stress is for their kids. How do you manage that? And is it a simple pat on the head to give permissions to kids to keep talking? Is that something that you have to live with?
Well, yes. I can speak from personal experience because my husband left for a 6-month deployment to Afghanistan on February 15th. And our son, who was normally, he has some issues. He has ADHD. However, there was this distinct change in his behavior. My husband left at 2:00 in the morning on February 15th, and that afternoon I got a call from the principal that he had an altercation on the playground and had had a meltdown, pretty much. So that was immediate. I mean, that was immediate for me. And yes, you need to talk to your children. You need to try to take care of their fears and let them, give them permission to talk. I totally agree with that. And it's a difficult situation. It's a difficult situation when you're going through multiple deployments like that because there's never a chance to really recoup. You're always kind of under stress.
So Angela Huebner, Associate Professor of Marriage and Family at Virginia Tech, I mean, it's fine to say talk to your kids, but if you're already over in Afghanistan, how do you do that?
Right. Well, it's interesting. Some of the stuff you're talking about, we've looked at in military kids and actually talked to them. And first, I want to say that the findings that we've found definitely echo exactly what you're saying about parents don't necessarily recognize. Kids in our studies would say, I'm having a really hard time, and we'd ask the parent, and these are military kids, and they would say, no, I think they're fine. So I think the communication is important, but I think first it's important to have the parent take care of themselves, because we're assuming that that everybody in the family is functioning well, and that's not the case necessarily. So talking before the deployment, having a good family environment before something bad happens is the best antidote.
And it's very serious challenges. We'll carry on that conversation on our website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks today to Angela Huebner, Associate Professor of Human Development at the Marriage and Family Program at Virginia Tech University, Lucien Bouc, who is a mobilization specialist at Fort Polk's Family Readiness Center, and Lisa Belkin. Thanks, as always. She writes the family and parenting blog Motherload for the New York Times.
As always, you can comment about that story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're also asking you, digging a bit deeper into that Fort Hood shooting, is the fact that Nidal Malik Hassan is a Muslim something that we should mention or ignore?
Of course we should mention that he's Muslim. That's part of the whole picture that you have to look at when evaluating the situation. And we have to, I think, put the political correctness aside and really focus on the heart of the matter. I don't know what it is, but being Muslim is just one piece of the puzzle that we have to consider.
And Matthew writes us on Facebook, I'm wondering whether vicarious PTSD was a factor. It's too early to say anything definitive about Major Hassan, but his being a psychiatrist raises a red flag. Most people don't realize the risks to mental health professionals who treat PTSD victims. That's post-traumatic stress disorder. Give us your take on Facebook or 8778-MY-TAKE. We've heard from people about this very thing, and we're going to continue this conversation. You can email us at mytake or thetakeaway.org. Our Facebook page is something you can subscribe to and respond there. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Ladies and gentlemen, history has been made.
For years, we've been told that this couldn't be done. Together we made it. See, we did it. We made it even though we had our backs up against the wall. After all, neither chamber of Congress has been able to pass a comprehensive health insurance reform bill for generations. But last night, the House proved different.
For nearly a century, since Teddy Roosevelt called for national health insurance in 1912, Americans have been waiting for reform, and it looks like we're almost there. The House passed their health care bill on Saturday, and we mark the occasion on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, November 9th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Celeste. So we're also going to be taking a look at the mental health resources in the military in the aftermath of the Fort Hood shootings. Are those resources sufficient? We're going to look at the stress of counseling the stressed out from Iraq and Afghanistan. Also, the Berlin Wall, a 20-year-old memory as of today. And college football rankings set to reset once again.
But first, Trudy Lieberman joins us. She's a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and healthcare blogger for CJR.org. Trudy, let's talk Turkey. Give me a percentage. How much of the House bill will actually end up in the final bill once it's been reconciled with the Senate version? That's assuming that the Senate passes it.
My best guess might be 50%.
So 50%, what's the first thing that's going to end up on the cutting room floor?
Most likely the public option.
So is that 50% in word count or in ideas?
In ideas, in financing method, in the fine print.
But the president says it's all paid for. We're going to get into real details with Trudy Lieberman. Stay with us. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
The devilish details coming right up. But in the headlines at Fort Hood, investigators, we learn, are waiting now to speak with the suspected shooter, Major Malik Hassan, who remains in critical condition in hospital. The head of the Army General George Casey says Hassan's Muslim faith must not mean that diversity in the armed forces becomes some kind of a victim of this incident. Meanwhile, there's been a call for a congressional probe into those killings. It's been called for by Chairman of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, Senator Joe Lieberman.
We don't know enough to say now, but there are very, very strong warning signs here that Dr. Hassan had become an Islamist extremist and therefore that this was a terrorist act.
That's independent Senator Joe Lieberman speaking. It's to CBS News over the weekend. After a landmark win in the House, President Obama begins his push for health care reform, as we said. Now in the Senate, Republicans have been pointing out that it's not just members of their party that voted against the House bill Saturday. 39 House Democrats also voted against. Kraft Foods has moved forward with a hostile takeover bid of the British candy maker Cadbury. The $16.4 billion deal would create a giant international food company. And Comcast and General Electric have agreed to value GE's NBC Universal unit at about $30 billion. That's less than the cost of a railroad, we learned.
That's
Warren Buffett buying Burlington Northern last week. It's good. A key point in talks between the two companies, they're working on a deal that would give Comcast a majority share in NBC Universal.
Meanwhile, two American pilots have died in Iraq after their helicopter crashed. A military statement said the two were killed on Sunday in the incident north of Baghdad. In neighboring Afghanistan, about 350 Taliban prisoners are on a hunger strike at an Afghan prison. A delegation from Afghanistan's Ministry of Justice is investigating their complaints about poor food, water, and health care in the prison. Wall Street was mostly flat on Friday. The Dow's going to open at 10,023 this morning. The S&P will kick off at 1069, and the NASDAQ opens at 2112. So speaking more about the Fort Hood shooting, many people responded and said, why are we labeling Nidal Malik Hassan as a Muslim? Why do we have to mention that? Other people have said, of course we're mentioning it. And we're asking you, should we mention it or ignore it?
This is Dale from Manhattan. If you're going to report that someone's Muslim American,
the responsible thing to do is to report everybody's religion. And so you can report that they're an Episcopal American, or they're an agnostic American, or they're a non-practicing Catholic American.
Disclose your religion at our show.
That's right.
8778-MY-TAKE.
Or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Okay, John, a little bit of a quiz this morning.
Okay.
Identify this sound. Here's a countdown. You tell me what it is.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
So that's a bunch of people in a bar watching a space shuttle launch?
No. It's not New
Close.
Year's. No. I guess you could compare the Congress to a people in a bar. That's actually something that Nancy Pelosi can clear up for you.
The yeas are 220. The nays are 215. The bill is passed.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi making that historic call on Saturday night. The Democrats were counting down the seconds until it was official that their health care reform bill had passed. And then,
Saturday
you know,
night
cheers.
Live. Yeah, there in the House.
That's
yeah.
right. Live from the House. It's Saturday Night Live. Here's a couple. We were watching the Twitter feeds, and there's extremely different characterizations of this vote. We have one from somebody named Kelly Burton RT said, 218 plus U.S. congressmen saddle Americans with the largest albatross in history. May the Senate reject it resoundingly. And Karen's tweets, number 218, if I could hug all of you, I would. Thank you for being fantastic human beings. So which is it? Is this a gigantic albatross or is this a huge victory? We're joined now by Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
So tell me, set the scene for us. What was it like during this vote in the House on this health care reform bill?
Yeah, lots of activity on the floor. The entire House present and very active running around the floor. Probably a little bit of last-minute whipping going on. We're all up in the press gallery just above the House chamber. You can't really see it on TV, but we're sort of right above the members watching the big board. There's a great big board on the back wall with all 435 members' names on it and lights, green for yay, red for nay, amber for present, which happens once in a while. And instead of watching the floor, you're spending a lot of time really watching the board to see who votes how. You know, we knew there was going to be a lot of moderate and conservative Democrats from the South, from those red states who rode Barack Obama's coattails in that last landslide election, who weren't going to be voting for this bill. So you got to watch the board and see where the votes are. Then you turn around and watch the floor and see if there's any Republicans who might be crossing over. There was one Republican who voted for this bill, and that's Joseph Gao. He's a Republican, but he represents the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans, and he got in because the guy who represented the lower Ninth Ward got indicted for bribery. So now he's a Republican in Congress, and he was sandwiched between a senior Republican and Eric Cantor, the Republican whip, sitting next to him
right.
until he voted. Then he put his green card in, and he voted with the Democrats. Cantor was very disappointed.
Okay, so Todd, kind of surprisingly, abortion turned out to be a big part of the last-minute negotiations before the vote. Very quickly, what happened here?
Yeah, there was an amendment sponsored by conservative pro-life Democrats. They demanded a vote on an amendment that would make it basically impossible for anyone purchasing insurance, health insurance on the national exchange that's envisioned in this bill from purchasing a plan that covers abortion, even with their own money. That is tighter than current law. It passed 240 to 194. A broad coalition passed this amendment before the final bill passed. Now, pro-choice Democrats, pro-choice progressives in the House were absolutely furious. Here's Diana DeGette. She's a deputy whip, and she's head of the pro-choice caucus. Listen to her.
This is a vast expansion of choice restrictions. It's probably the biggest restriction on a woman's right to choose that will have been considered on the House floor in my career.
And we'll DeGette and her allies were forced to roll over on this. They lost that vote, but many of them voted to pass the bill anyway
right.
because they said it was just too important.
And that may or may not survive when they reconcile it with the Senate. But let's go now to Trudy. Thanks very much, Todd Zwillick. He's our Takeaway Washington correspondent. And let's turn to Trudy Lieberman now, contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and healthcare blogger for CJR.org. So, Trudy, we have questions from our listeners. I'm gonna play some of these comments from our listeners. The first one is from Sean, New Jersey, and he's concerned about cost.
I'm Sean from Bradley Beach, and the one most important thing I'd like to see in the health care bill
is competition, competition, competition. It's the one thing our insurance industry and healthcare doesn't really have.
So does this House bill that they passed on Saturday foster competition between insurance companies?
Well, ostensibly, the public plan option is supposed to do that, but the latest numbers out from the Congressional Budget Office show that only about 6 million people will be able to join the public plan anyway. Those would be individuals who do not have insurance from their employer or small businesses buying coverage for their workers. So the plan is going to be very limited. The CBO also said that they expect that the costs will be even higher for some people in the public plan because it's likely to attract sicker people, which means the insurance companies have to raise the price. So I don't know that we can really expect much competition, but I think the thing to remember here is that the cost drivers in the system are really not the insurance companies. They're the doctors and hospitals, and they are the ones who set the prices.
Okay, so we actually had a comment from Bill in Brooklyn about those costs.
Physicians are paid over twice as much as they are in Britain, where the standard of living is about the same. I think doctors should be very well compensated for their work, but I don't think we should be making them multimillionaires. I think it's not good for their character, and I don't think it's good for the public.
So he's talking about controlling the costs that you were talking about. Does this bill do that?
Not very well. The cost control measures in this bill, as well as in the Senate bill, are rather weak. And I think it's important to note that the doctors are very intent on getting their growth formula cut, and that means that the scheduled fee cuts will not be taking effect. And so they're working very hard right now in Congress to make sure that those fee cuts that have been scheduled for over a decade now will not happen.
And the fact that those cost-cutting moves aren't in the House bill is a victory for Republicans. That's an irony here, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So quickly, Trudy, we just have about a minute left, but I wanted you to play something from George Miller, a Democrat from California. He said, the most important words never again will be Americans be without health insurance. They will never lose their insurance again. And I'm wondering, is that true? Is this going to cover Americans forever and ever in perpetuity?
There are lots of ways that people will not still be covered under health insurance. I'll give you one very quickly. The House bill, as well as the Senate bills, requires the companies or allows the companies, insurance companies, to age rate. That means that they can charge older people much more than they can charge younger people, which will mean some of those people will not be able to afford the insurance.
Okay, Trudy Lieberman is a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and healthcare blogger for CJR.org. It's 15 minutes past the hour now for a look at everything else we've been watching today.
So in the last few minutes, judicial officials in Iran say three American citizens who entered the country from Iraq, saying they were journalists, have been charged with spying. The three were arrested back in July. We'll update you on that later on in the program. The House passed its health care plan this weekend by just 5 votes. President Obama says it's the Senate's turn now, but Senator Lindsey Graham tells CBS News that Republicans there are gearing up for a fight.
The House bill is dead on arrival in the Senate. Just look at how it passed. It passed 220 to 215. It passed by 2 votes. You had 39 Democrats vote against the bill.
That's a doctor and Senator Lindsey Graham talking about a dead-on-arrival bill. A major sticking point continues to be the creation of a public option to compete with private insurers.
Instead of sweetening its offer, Kraft Foods has moved forward with a hostile takeover of the British candy maker Cadbury. The $16.4 billion deal would create a giant international food company with combined revenues approaching $50 billion a year.
And a hostile takeover means they're going to talk directly to shareholders.
That's exactly right. And say,
hey,
we're offering this
exactly.
And you could make money off of it. Let's bypass the board. And they're calling it the equivalent of Godzilla swallowing Rockefeller Center. Comcast and General Electric have agreed to value GE's NBC Universal unit at around $30 billion. That's been a key point in merger talks between the two companies that would create one of the world's largest media companies.
I wonder what GE paid for NBC back many years ago.
That's a good question.
Ago.
I don't even.
We should find that out.
Let's look at some.
Email
of
us with that if you know
exactly.
It.
Let's look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. And I know somebody who might have the answer is New York Times' Louise Story. She's going to talk to us though about the windfall bonuses that are being handed out to executives of bailed out banks. They say it's a good idea. Do you think that it's a good idea? We're going to ask that question to Louise Story in just a few minutes.
You're listening.
listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Oh, yeah. Let's get some takeouts to go on stories we want you to stay on top of this week. And sitting at the short order counter this morning, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports takeaway contributor. And good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
Also, Louise Story is here, finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
All right. So we're all here together in the studio. Let's begin with you, Louise. You know, bank pay is pretty good this year, even though the industry is doing horribly. Part of that is something we should be outraged about, but part of it is because the numbers are so strange in this economic downturn. Explain what's going on this week.
So you already think bank pay is high.
Right.
But part of the reason it's so high is because a lot of it's in stock and options. And you know, the stock of a lot of the financial companies in the last year has recovered from historic lows. So let me give you an example.
Right.
At Goldman last year, they cut the pay of their executives. So for some of their executives, they gave them $5 million expected value of stock and options. That was a pay cut, mind
you.
But get this. Now those same stock and options are worth $12 million.
Wow. So a buy low, sell high kind of classic cycle.
And the question here is this because the management of these banks is so brilliant, or is this because the government and you, the taxpayers, helped repair the financial system, and that's helped the stock of all these companies.
But that's why you're here. Which is it, Louise?
Well, you know, Ibrahim's here, too, and I was thinking this morning, it's kind of like those fancy swimsuits, you know, that the swimmers wore that caused all the controversy.
The aerodynamic stuff.
Right, and then they go break the records, and you had to, you know, wonder if it was because of the swimsuits they broke the records or their great strokes, and that's the question here.
All right, so on the issue of incentives, some would say, we need to get out of this. We need to move forward. Paying these guys with these inflated stock and options is a good idea to get them going to keep the momentum of the economy.
The positive is that it aligns the executives with the shareholders, that if the stock goes up, shareholders benefits, the executives benefit. The problem is we're not in a normal environment, and there's not as much downside risk for these companies. You know, the government's made it clear they're not going to let Citigroup, for instance, fail. So when they pay 96% of compensation at Citigroup in stock, you have to wonder, is that executive money really at risk? Is there more upside than downside?
How much of an incentive is it, actually? Well, Louise Story, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next, for Sports Takeout with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We've been looking forward to the weekend in football, and some interesting things happened in college football. What happened in the Ohio State versus the Penn State game?
Well, first of all, Ohio State won 24-7 in a game that was billed to be Terrell Pryor, who's from Pennsylvania, but who's the quarterback for Ohio State, his return home to see 100,000 fans in Happy Valley, Pennsylvania, cheering against him in his home area. And he came out.
College fans are nasty.
And they're mean. Yeah, exactly.
But so he didn't get booed like Brett Favre, right?
He definitely got some tough,
tough love.
The crowd. Yeah, they treated him tough. But he actually responded well, and he came through, and he had a great game, and Ohio State won. They're now the team to beat in the Big Ten, but they won't be playing for a national championship. There were some other games this weekend. Notre Dame was beaten by Navy 23-21 in a game that basically put Charlie Weiss's, as the head coach of Notre Dame, his time on a ticker. Notre Dame needed to win that game in the BCS conversation, but now they're not in it anymore.
No, that's a game of battleship, and Charlie Weiss definitely is sunk by the Navy.
Indeed. Yeah. The other game that I was looking at really was Cincinnati. Cincinnati's been undefeated. They played against UConn. They were blowing them out early in the game, and they ended up winning a real squeaker 45-47.
But they
that
still
was a
remained
great game.
Undefeated.
They do remain undefeated,
and
correct.
My Ducks got beat by Stanford.
So. Yeah, that was ugly for the Ducks.
We were talking about the college rankings getting reset. What are we talking about here?
Well, right now, because of some of the teams that were in the mix that are no longer in the mix, like Iowa. Iowa's out. So there's some teams. So basically, you have teams like Alabama, Texas, and Florida. Those are the big three, and they're solid in the BCS picture. Exactly.
In the top 10.
But now you have other teams, TCU, you have Cincinnati, some teams that are mixing, matching. But it's almost, the New York Times wrote about this today. The picture for the end of the season is a little boring to see who's going to end up being in the title game, because we kind of know who's going to be there. We have to see if Texas is going to slip up or Alabama is going to slip up, and they could. They play Auburn later in the season, right, and that could possibly happen.
And Boise, maybe.
And Boise is definitely in the mix, and Boise that's State, another part, yeah, of the picture, yes.
And, you know, I mean, the irony here is, as the bowl games proliferate, there are more bowl games than ever before, the number of elite teams shrinks.
It does shrink.
That makes it really bad for people who want to watch bowls.
And then you have all these elite teams that don't have tough schedules, so they don't schedule tough games like they used to do in the past.
Luis, what do you think of Ibrahim's aerodynamic swimsuit that he's wearing here?
That's pretty very wild. Cute on him.
It's very shiny. Very
cute.
Very shiny.
We need the webcam on.
All right, so let's
why
step
is the
away.
Webcam broken today?
Hey, step away very quickly, Ibrahim. We've got Monday Night Football with the Denver Broncos, no longer undefeated, but they're going up against the Pittsburgh Steelers. What are we watching for in this game?
Let's not forget the Pittsburgh Steelers are the defending champions. No, they're a passing offense. They're going to be very difficult to stop. The Broncos' defense has been excellent this year, but they're not going to win two. They're going to lose two games in a row. They're going to lose their second game of the season because Pittsburgh is on a roll.
Oh, and they're going to be playing at a mile high, right?
So. Indeed. I think Ben Roethlisberger is great on the road.
Even at home, lose, you think.
Okay. Takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
And no matter what, I mean, the Broncos are still in there. I mean, they're
without
definitely
a doubt.
In there. Yeah, I mean, that's the
doubt.
Interesting thing. Exactly. All right, Ibrahim and Louise, thanks so much
for being here. Let me get the swimsuit off now. Yeah.
The takeout from last Friday's show was all about the relevance of religion in that discussion that we had of the alleged Fort Hood shooters. The fact that Nidal Malik Hassan was a Muslim, something to mention or ignore in coverage? Or is it an issue about stresses in the military that's more relevant?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's as simple as either one of the two choices, military or Islam. This man obviously has some problems going into this thing, and that's what is common to all these kind of events.
We'll be getting your reaction, so tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You were part of that discussion on Friday, Ibrahim. I mean, it's interesting. Religion is part of the puzzle, one of our listeners said this morning. Do you agree?
I think it's important to have that conversation because it's real and it's there, but I don't think it tells the whole story.
All right. Coming up, mental health is also an issue in the Fort Hood shootings. We're going to talk more about the issues that military members face. Is it a scarcity of resources or is it just a matter of not asking for help? That in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, we're going to look at mental health resources in the armed forces in the wake of last week's massacre at Fort Hood. But right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Wall Street is open and there's a rally underway. Both the Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P are up significantly in the very, very early going. President Obama's push for health care reform passes the House of Representatives over the weekend, but it's facing a unified Republican opposition in the Senate. Today is the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Thousands are celebrating at the Brandenburg Gate today, where giant dominoes are being toppled to symbolize how communist governments in Eastern Europe fell one after another back in 1989.
Yesterday was a day of remembrance and healing for the families devastated by last week's deadly shooting rampage at the Fort Hood military base. Many came together for a memorial service. Mandy Foster is the wife of a soldier wounded in the Fort Hood shooting.
I didn't think it was real until I got to the hospital. I didn't know what to think when everything happened.
Her husband, Private Joseph Foster, was shot in the hip and, despite his injury, is ready to ship out to Afghanistan in January. That's some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Well, in the words of that Private Joseph Foster, who claims despite his injury in the shooting at Fort Hood, he's ready to ship out to Afghanistan. The impact is being felt at Fort Hood. And to give us an update on what's going on in the community around that base, which is the largest combat military base in the United States, Olga Pena is managing editor of the Killeen Daily Herald. Good morning again, Olga.
Good morning.
First of all, you know, we've got a lot more information about the suspect. And we've got a lot more in terms of ceremonies and events at the base. There's a memorial service scheduled for tomorrow. What are the preparations like at this point?
Well, the community is just, it's unbelievable how they're rallying around. Yesterday was Sunday, and of course, numerous churches in the area held many different services for these soldiers. Even Saturday was the same way. So people are looking forward to tomorrow's event. I think it's going to be a massive, massive turnout as this community rallies in a way that I've just never seen before.
You know, I've been to ceremonies where soldiers come back from deployments, and you have around the base kind of symbols, little shrines that are set up. I remember a welcome home, you know, written in styrofoam cups in chain link fences. Are things like that happening at the base, where you see little mementos here and there around the base in very sort of special ways expressed?
Absolutely, everywhere. It's in the community even before you get close to Fort Hood at various signs. Anybody who has a billboard or a sign, you know, they've changed what the message says. It says, you know, our thoughts and prayers are with those victims and their families. And at Fort Hood, towards the entrances, you can see flags that are set up. There are flags in the ground. There are persons actually waving flags outside with signs, not because anyone is around, but just showing that they are supportive of these families. It's unbelievable.
Well, Olga Pena, managing editor of the Killeen Daily Herald, covering the events there, as we said, a memorial service tomorrow. Olga, thanks so much for helping us to understand what this community is going through. Okay, expressions of solidarity there. You hear that from Olga Pena, but is it enough? What do service people and their families, and particularly service professionals who have the responsibility of helping service members with the stresses of deployments, do they have the resources that they need? It's certainly a question posed in the aftermath of what happened at Fort Hood. Joining us now is Brett A. Moore, a clinical psychologist who served as a psychologist in the U.S. Army from 2003 to 2008, was in Iraq for 27 months. Brett Moore, good morning.
Good morning.
And Nelson Ford is the CEO of LMI. He's the former undersecretary of the Army. That's a civilian member of the civilian leadership of the Army. And Nelson Ford, good morning.
Good morning.
Brett Moore, first of all, we heard a lot last Friday about the stress of dealing with people who are under stress in terms of multiple deployments. What's that like? I mean, what is that stress like as you talk to soldier after soldier after soldier?
Well, it's trying. It takes a toll on a mental health professional having to hear. I mean, not seeing, obviously, seeing traumatic events is one thing, but also hearing traumatic events and helping soldiers get through these issues, it really takes a toll on mental health providers. And you can develop what some call compassion fatigue, which is where you really lose connection with your patients and really possibly lose even empathy and experience your own psychological symptoms related to that.
So what happens? I mean, who do you talk to when you need to talk to someone? I mean, do you go home and kick your dog? I mean, excuse me, but I mean, I'm wondering where the outlets are for someone like you.
Well, yeah, it's a great question. You have to be able to recognize when you're not functioning the best that you could. You have an obligation to your patients, so hopefully the individual will say, listen, something's not going on the way it should be. I need to talk to another professional. And with Army psychology, it's a very close-knit community, and everyone knows everyone. So not only do you have people looking out for you, but there's usually that open-door policy where if you feel you're struggling a little, you can go to a superior or even a peer and say, I need some help getting through this. Can you give me some perspective?
Nelson Ford, you were the former undersecretary of the Army. You know, he's talking about the support of the military having trouble dealing with it. And we see this in other professions. Actually, war correspondents often have to come home and get mental health care when they deal with the things that they're hearing about and the things that they're seeing. What kind of support does the Army have, does the military have, for the support staff of the military?
Oh, the support is great. I have to say that the Army has done such a good job at making sure that people are identified when they have problems. Beginning in 2005, there were both pre- and post-deployment health assessments for both physical and mental condition. In 2007, it instituted universal PTSD training so that you could identify who was showing the symptoms of PTSD and telling soldiers what to do about it. There was a major effort in 2008 to understand suicide and why the suicide rates were increasing. And just recently, the Army announced a new program of resilience training so that soldiers can be trained to both physically and mentally prepare to be in these tough environments.
Well, Brett Moore, I don't want to be argumentative, and in the short time that we have, I'll take this question back to Brett Moore. I mean, given those increases in resources that Nelson Ford talks about, former Undersecretary of the Army, it was apparently missed here. I mean, Major Nidal Malik Hassan did not, A, take the initiative to get help, and nobody noticed that he was getting near some sort of a breaking point. Brett Moore, what's your response to that?
Well, there has to be some personal responsibility. When you go through training as any psychologist, psychiatrist, you're taught that you need to be aware of some of the symptoms in yourself, and there is that personal responsibility. You have to ask for help. Hopefully, your peers, if something's going on, they will recognize that, they will confront you with it, and then refer that up the chain of command so you can go get some type of help. So it's not.
But hopefully, isn't going to help the 12 dead in Fort Hood.
Well, it's not a perfect system, but right. I think it's the same in the civilian sector.
Right.
There is no safety net. Nelson talked about an increase that the Army has done, and they have done a tremendous job, in my opinion, as well. But, again, there's that personal responsibility.
Well, Brett, I have to ask you before we go. You know, Nelson Fort talks about the resources. But obviously, and we don't want to justify under any circumstances what went on. There's no explanation for it, and authorities are going to talk to the suspect. What was your breaking point, Brett Amore, when you decided you'd had enough?
Well, my situation is a little unique. I did a 12-month and then a back 15-month deployment, and I decided I needed to take a break and do something else.
And burnout was really the issue there.
Yeah, professional burnout was part of the problem, yeah.
And it's not only a problem for Brett Moore. Great discussion. Brett Moore is a clinical psychologist. He served in Iraq for 27 months, counseling service members deploying in and out of Iraq. Nelson Fort, who we also spoke to, is the CEO of the company LMI and former civilian member of the Pentagon. He was Undersecretary of the Army. Coming up, it's been 20 years since a wall split the city of Berlin. We'll take a look at the effects of two decades of German unification. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Since the mass killings last Friday's show was all about the relevance of religion in the discussion of the alleged Fort Hood shooter, is the fact that Nidal Malik Hassan was a Muslim something that we need to consider or ignore?
This is Tom from Michigan. I'm surprised that you think it's important to mention that the shooter in this tragedy was Muslim. You would not mention a Christian psychiatrist or a Jewish psychiatrist. And I think that is very unfortunate.
I don't understand why the major's religion is not an issue. He allegedly was posting to jihadi websites years ago and has been under FBI investigation, and nobody should ever be singled out for their religion. But maybe this could have been a terrorist case or an isolated terrorist case.
Well, it's certainly what investigators are going to be looking at when they begin to question the suspect today. He's in the hospital in a stable but a critical condition. People on the website were all over the map on whether we should ignore or mention his religion, but a lot of people wanted to explore the motives for doing one or the other.
Of course we should mention that he's Muslim. That's part of the whole picture that you have to look at when evaluating the situation. And we have to, I think, put the political correctness aside and really focus on the heart of the matter. I don't know what it is, but being Muslim is just one piece of the puzzle that we have to consider.
I think it's important to talk about the fact that he was Muslim because it highlights that we had one person out of the 3,000 or more Muslims in the military, one person, a very minute percentage, who basically took extremist side and extremist point of view and acted out on it. So it's important to highlight this is a very small percentage of extremism, even in our country.
And of course, the accused shooter, Hassan, was more than just a Muslim. He was a lot of different things.
When Timothy McVeigh attacked the Oklahoma office building, we didn't all of a sudden start saying, oh, my God, what religion is he? He might be Christian. Oh, he's Irish. Oh, maybe we ought to investigate the IRA. Oh, maybe this is... what if maybe the guy was really upset about the war and what's going on in Iraq?
Sure. I think it's important that you talk about if he's a Muslim, then it shouldn't be ignored. But also got to be careful if you're going to demonize him in that way. Also, I heard that he was Palestinian, which struck me as kind of interesting, especially because the media seemed to ignore that also.
The conversation continues on our website, where Shab Adel in Detroit emailed us, why is the media only focusing on Fort Hood? What about the Orlando, Florida shooting at an engineering firm last Friday where one person died and five were wounded? Is it only because the Texas incident has a Muslim in it? Since the Orlando shooter was not a Muslim, we did not hear anything about his religion or even about the incident.
There's also a theme from many of you. If we judge him because of his faith, we should judge everyone based on who they worship.
This is Nancy Jennings calling from Detroit, Michigan. Christians commit atrocities all the time. I am a Christian. That doesn't absolve us from the bad things that happen. And we shouldn't characterize our Muslim countrymen any differently than we characterize any other religion.
I think it's important to mention the person's religious background, but I think it has to be done across the board in all cases. For example, in the huge roundup of criminals this past summer in New Jersey, it was very interesting that the press did note that many of the suspects were rabbis. However, that in time has been downplayed tremendously to the point that now stories do not cover the rabbinical side of the story.
Your story is at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headlee here at John Hockenberry. Coming up, we will head to Berlin to talk about the 20-year anniversary today of the fall of the Berlin Wall and how that means going forward from 20 years ago. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Judicial officials in Iran say three American citizens who entered the country from Iraq have been charged with spying. The three were arrested after they crossed into Iran in July. Their families say they were hiking and strayed across the border accidentally. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has called on the Iranian authorities to release them. In Afghanistan, President Hamid Karzai says he'll replace ministers and senior officials tainted with corruption. Speaking on PBS, he said some people have already been dismissed from their posts.
Back home, investigators in the Fort Hood shootings are waiting to interview the suspected shooter who remains in the hospital. 13 died, 29 were injured. There's a lot of talk about the suspect's Muslim faith, but Army Chief George Casey says diversity in the armed forces must not be a victim of this shooting.
Our diversity, not only in our Army, but in our country, is a strength. And as horrific as this tragedy was, if our diversity becomes a casualty, I think that's worse.
That's the head of the Army, General George Casey. Thousands of people are in Berlin today remembering the events of 20 years ago when the Berlin Wall came down.
Nowhere is the division between East and West seen more clearly than in Berlin.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I never have seen Berlin without this wall.
Voices from the events leading up to the fall of the Berlin Wall 20 years ago. Joining us now is Roz Atkins, host of the BBC's World Have Your Say. We spoke with you just an hour or so ago, and I'm wondering if the events in Berlin today are beginning to pick up.
Hi, John. Hi, Celeste. Good to speak to you. I'm in a bookstore about a kilometer down the road from the Brandenburg Gate. Still no events taking place actually by the Brandenburg Gate. If you go up there, there's floodlights up on the major monuments all around there. There's a huge stage where one of the big orchestras here in Germany is going to be performing along with Bon Jovi and Paul Van Dyk a little bit later. But at the moment, there's just a real sense of excitement. There are thousands of people out and about on the streets. A lot of the streets have been blocked off, so there's no traffic, and you can just see people milling around, eating some food, drinking some beer, and waiting for events to get underway in around three hours' time.
So, Roz Atkins of the BBC, the characters from history 20 years ago, you've got Mikhail Gorbachev, of course, the Soviet leader at the time. You've got Helmut Kohl, charitably, the portly Helmut Kohl, who was the leader of West Germany at the time. Angela Merkel, who's the chancellor of the unified Germany, is much more of a lightweight, quite literally, but she's going to be a part of these ceremonies later today. What have you heard?
Well, I think everyone's very interested to see what Angela Merkel has to say. Her family comes from what was East Germany, so there's a particular attention on the speech she's going to give. And I think there's also a huge symbolism in the fact that she will walk with Mikhail Gorbachev from what was East into West, the same walk that thousands of people made 20 years ago. And I think the event itself, rather than any particular words, is what people are focusing on. But this is a personal thing. Everyone
right.
I'm speaking to is looking at this through their eyes. They remember where they were 20 years ago. They remember how they felt, and they're comparing those feelings with what's happened in the past 20 years.
Is it less global history and more personal history, Roz Atkins?
I think it is. I think there's two things going on. One is people are comparing how they felt about their lives and the country they lived in 20 years ago with what Germany has become. But then also you've got to remember two things were driving this pulling down of the wall. It was a desire for capitalism and it was a desire for democracy. Some people thought this was the beginning of the whole world taking on those two things. It hasn't worked out that way. And so people also are reflecting on whether some commentators jumped the gun and thinking that 1989 was actually heralding worldwide democracy, worldwide capitalism. Seems 20 years on, some people still don't want that.
Yes, indeed. Well said. Thank you, Roz Atkins, host of World Have Your Say, a show on our partner, the BBC.
And we're now joined by two people with very special insight into the fall of the Berlin Wall. Christoph Niemann is a New York Times artist. He grew up in West Germany and lived in New York for 10 years. Christoph, you now live in Berlin with your wife and three kids, and you're very close to where the wall used to stand.
We're really only 200 feet away from where it all happened. And we're on the eastern side, but basically when I go buy a pint of milk, I buy it in the Evil Empire, coming from their view.
And
then you walk back. It went stunning when you see all the memorials, when you see all the plaques on the sides of the street. You're constantly reminded of what happened there.
And you're the person that actually described it. I said it's no more than a bump in the road, but you were talking about going over it on your bike.
Well, what they did is the wall was removed. It was very important that the city grew back together, but they, of course, want to make it visible for everybody. So basically, it's a twin row of cobblestones that kind of wiggles along the streets. And when you take your bike or when you take a stroller over it, it's just this little ta-dunk. And you know that now you did a step that 20 years ago was absolutely unfathomable.
Okay, so Christoph grew up in West Germany. We also have Louisa Strauss with us, photo editor at New York Times Magazine. You're 36 years old now, so you were 16 when the wall fell. And you grew up in East Germany.
I grew up in East Germany, and I was 16 at the time, so I totally knew what was going on. My parents were part of the opposition, so they didn't play by the rules, which meant that I wasn't allowed to go to university, because education, like everything else in East Germany, it was government controlled. So I had to choose an apprenticeship. So in September of 1989, I found myself in the back of the university library dusting books and sorting books instead of in the front taking them out, which is what I wanted to do.
So let me take you both back to 20 years ago, and from both sides of the wall we can get our impression of the day that the Berlin Wall fell. So Louisa, coming from East Germany, when that wall came down, what did it look like from the East German side?
It was just so, as Christoph said, unfathomable. Like, everything happened so fast. These demonstrations started happening, and I remember being in a classroom and having a big discussion with our teacher, who was completely against these demonstrations, telling us, you know, you can't go to this, you'll end up in prison, don't do this, and the whole class getting up, walking out, and joining a demonstration. So it was just a very, it all happened so fast. It was incredibly surprising. So the day the wall came down, I was actually I was not in Berlin. I was at a funeral for a cousin of mine. So I can't remember that moment, but it was such a huge surprise. We couldn't. Sure. I was at this funeral. My cousin came to the wall down. We said, "What? That's just not possible.
It can't be happening. Christoph, from the West German side, how did it look?"
Well, I was 17. I was very politically interested. I was watching TV, and it was the classic, "Mom, Dad, you want to come over and see what's happening on TV?" moments. It was really wild. And you know, from what I know, like the KGB and the CIA didn't know either. Everybody was just like, "What the hell's happening here?"
And this metaphor of a stroller bump today,
to dunk,
really. I mean, it really says a lot. I mean, people did not believe it could come down, but in the end, poof, it was blown away. That says a lot about what we think is important in world history and what turns out being the sort of memorable legacy, right?
Yeah, and I also find it amazing. Like, back then, when I grew up, it was like the East and the West. It seemed like these two ideologies working against each other, but ultimately, there were so many layers of economy, of really also internal struggles within the East. And without Gorbachev, it wouldn't have happened. Without the USSR having problems, it wouldn't have happened. So it's such a complex thing. But ultimately, it boiled down to, in Berlin, as a very like dramatic part of history for the people who lived there, right? People being separated from their parents for 20 years.
Right, but this dramatic history, and you wrote this great blog for the New York Times about this, and you discuss living really close to where the very first woman died, jumping out of the three-story window. And now you're moving on to the next generation and explaining this to your three kids, that this cobblestone strip once represented a wall. So how do you explain that to the next generation that doesn't see it?
Well, it's going to be interesting. I read something in the Times the other day where now kids think like, oh, it's like grandpa talking about the war again, where
right.
like this, they're tired. Right. On the one hand, it's beautiful that they're tired of it, that it's like now a new world. But on the other hand, in history is so visible in Berlin, and you know, not only the wall, but of course what came before and what's so much bigger than the wall. And it follows you at every step of the way. And I'm really glad that the kids are going to grow up with this humility of knowing all the things that led to the life that they live today.
All right. Christoph Neumann is a New York Times artist. He grew up in West Germany, now lives in Berlin with his wife and three kids, 200 feet from where the wall once stood. Louisa Staus, photo editor at the New York Times magazine. She was 16 when the wall fell and grew up in East Germany. Thanks to both of you.
And thanks to our partner, the New York Times. If you think the Berlin Wall is more than just a speed bump, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We'd love to hear your remembrance. We also have an email on the mental health resources available to families at Fort Hood. Melissa emailed us and said, I'm a mental health therapist from a military family. Although military personnel are encouraged to get treatment for mental health issues, there's an unspoken stigma attached to getting help, she writes. Treatment is supposed to be confidential. However, military personnel fear their peers will learn they are getting treatment, or by simply speaking to a therapist, everyone will look at them differently. Weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.